The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Shalom, everybody. Shalom. How are you? My name is Leo Vinovesky. I am the Israeli consul in Philadelphia and the Mid-Atlantic region. And I want to thank Andy. Where is Andy? Andy Cohen and Sarah. I want to thank them. I want to thank the library for this opportunity to introduce Professor Michael Oren, this opportunity in the land of opportunities. But actually, it's a big honor for me today to be here. And you probably know, as we are diplomats, and you probably know which is the role, the main role of the diplomat. Does anybody know here in this hall? Usually to say a few words. So I will say a few words today, because the main dish is behind the stage. This is a unique opportunity, actually. But I understand Michael Oren. I understand Michael Oren because, especially, I grew up, I raised in a place in another country, not in Israel. I lived for 20 years in Argentina, and they made Aliyah, immigrated to Israel. So I understand his approach of race in one place, to live in another place, and to have the perspective of the both countries, of the two realities. And it's important, it's unique. And I know, I understand also Michael Oren because he is so proud of his two citizenships that you won't find every day such a case. And probably this book, this specific book, will enable us, will lead us to understand the past and the present. And probably, and this is really a challenge, will lead us to understand the future in the Middle East. The role of America in the Middle East, also in the future. So in this book, he's asking tough questions, he's asking brave questions, and probably this book will lead to another book to understand the future role of the states in the Middle East, in a very complicated region, very complicated area, and I must say you, complicated neighbors. But, and the more important in my eyes, is that we have the opportunity, the unique opportunity, to have here a man that not only was born in America and then immigrated to Israel, but the main important point, the main important question, is that he was a fighter. He is a historian. He was assistant to a number of prime ministers in Israel. He knows the reality from inside the problem. And perhaps this is the uniqueness of this book, of his work. You know, the main role of the diplomat is to say a few words, so I will give the microphone and the stage to Michael Oren. It's a pleasure to have here an American-born Israeli. It's our proud to have Michael Oren here, and I'm proud to share this evening with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good evening, everybody. It's so a singular pleasure to be back in Philadelphia. What you don't hear from my resume often is that I was, as a younger man, I was an oarsman, and I used to row out of the Undine, yes, thank you, out of the Undine Club on the Schuylkill. I hope I said that right. And had very fond memories of Philadelphia, became an avid Thomas Aikens fan. I understand that's controversial, huh? And And in 1982, you may recall, there was a Middle East war. Yes, one of those wars. And it was the first one I was in. I was sent up to Beirut. I came out of Beirut because basically my unit was decimated, and I came back, and I was supposed to get married in August. I got married in August. And right after the ceremony, we were unpacking our gifts and getting preparing to go off on our honeymoon. The phone rang, and it was my commanding officer telling us that the unit had been reconstituted and that I was to meet him on the corner where a Jeep would pick me up at 7 o'clock in the morning and take me back to Beirut. And so my new bride is out in the street crying, and as I go back to the brewery, and we never had our honeymoon. Flash forward a month later, I start graduate school not so far from here in Princeton, New Jersey, and my wife turns to me and says, how about that honeymoon? I said, I have the ideal place. Let's go on our honeymoon to Philadelphia. Now, I must tell you, we had the most extraordinary time. What a city. History, food, theater, everything. And I think I just want to strongly recommend that you refashion your city. Imagine this. Philadelphia, the honeymoon capital of the world. See, you're laughing. All right, imagine something else. Imagine that you are a very high-ranking American diplomat sent to conduct some sensitive negotiations with a representative of a Middle Eastern state which is engaged in hostilities against the United States. And imagine that you meet with this envoy in some European capital and you say to him that the American people bear no animosity whatsoever to the peoples of this Middle Eastern kingdom, indeed to all Middle Eastern peoples. The United States merely wants to conduct its commerce freely in this area of the world without threat of harm. And imagine this envoy then turns to you and says, no, we don't want peace with you. In fact, we want war with you, we intend to conduct a war because we have a holy book that tells us that we must conduct a war to enslave your infidel state, indeed all infidel states. And our holy book further tells us that if our soldiers die in the pursuit of this battle, that they will go directly to paradise. Now, I would imagine that if you were to listen to this response from a Middle Eastern envoy, your reply would be, well, the United States really has no choice but to defend itself against this threat. America has no option but to go to war. And if you reach that conclusion, then you will have reached precisely the conclusion arrived at by America's envoy in this particular negotiation. His name was Thomas Jefferson. The month was March. In the year 1785, his Middle Eastern interlocutor was the representative of the Pasha of Tripoli. His name was Abdulrahman al-Najjar. Tripoli was one of the four so-called Barbary states, what would be today be Tripoli and Libya, of course, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And during this period, the Barbary states were preying upon America's commerce in the Middle East. Now, America's commerce was vital to the survival of this country. About 20% of all American exports went through this region of the world. America was a seafaring nation with a very fragile economy. The Barbary pirates literally posed an existential threat to this nascent United States. And the United States had no means of responding to this threat. America had managed to emerge from the revolution without a single warboat intact, no warships whatsoever. But more to the point, the United States didn't have the means of creating a navy because the 13 states were loosely confederated under the Articles of Confederation. They didn't have a central government, no means of raising taxes, no means of even creating naval power. Jefferson wanted to federate. Jefferson wanted to fight. He believed it was America's temper, as he called it, not to give in to bribery. But many other Americans took issue with him. They believed that America was better off following the age-old European custom of bribing the pirates. At one point during the Adams administration, about 20% of America's federal income was going to bribing the pirates. And they were concerned that America would get bogged down in an open-ended war in the distant Middle East, and they, rather than fight the pirates, they preferred to negotiate and palliate them. Today, more than 220 years later, Americans are confronting some similar threats in the Middle East and grappling with similar choices. They have to decide whether to fight or to negotiate. whether to palliate their enemies or whether to destroy them. Today, Americans are being asked to make some very fateful decisions regarding their involvement in the Middle East, decisions that will impact not only their security, but the security of many nations in the world. And yet, few Americans are fully aware that their founding fathers faced similar situations, situations indeed not unlike their own. Few Americans know of their centuries-long legacy in the Middle East. It's a rich and multifaceted heritage of war and of statecraft, of altruism and beneficence, of wild artistic imaginings and swashbuckling adventure. Rather, a great many Americans, it seems, believe that their country's involvement in this crucial area began sometime in the aftermath of World War II, with the advent of the Arab-Israeli conflict, the deepening American dependence on Middle Eastern oil, the Cold War in the Middle East. Most would be shocked to hear, I believe, that not only Thomas Jefferson, but also Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln had important Middle Eastern policies. They would be astonished to know that about 500 Egyptian soldiers served in the North American continent during the Civil War, and that one of the people implicated in the Lincoln assassination plot escaped to and was arrested in Egypt. They would perhaps be most shocked of all to learn that the original Statue of Liberty showed a veiled Arab woman holding a torch, and that the original lyrics of the Star-Spangled Banner spoke of turbaned Middle Easterners bowing down to the victorious flag of the United States. Now, I, too, once upon a time, would have subscribed to this notion that American involvement in the Middle East began after World War II. Again, going back about 25 years ago when I was a graduate student at Princeton, I was sitting in a lecture by a professor on Arab history and Egyptian history, and he mentioned off the cuff that in the late 1860s, a group of Civil War veterans, Confederate and Union officers, reunited and traveled to Egypt to help modernize the Egyptian army. And while they were there, they discovered that most soldiers in this army, even most officers, were illiterate, and they set to building a school system to teach literacy to these Egyptian soldiers, and the Egyptian soldiers began to bring their children. So these Civil War officers got into the business of teaching literacy to Egyptian school children, and while they were at it, they taught them American ideals of civic virtues, patriotism, and democracy. Now, I was fascinated by this. I ran off to the library to read more about it, and I was very disappointed to see that while there were many books on the history of Great Britain in the Middle East, the history of France in the Middle East, there was no comprehensive history of America in the Middle East. There was nothing, certainly, that would put these officers' singular experience in some type of historical context. You flash forward about two decades to the aftermath of 9/11, and suddenly it seemed to me that America's need for an historic point of reference for plotting its future course in the Middle East became especially acute. And so, in about 2002, when my editor and good friend at Norton Press, Bob Weil, asked me what I thought was the one book about the Middle East that had yet to be written but which had to be written, I didn't hesitate a nanosecond. I responded, America in the Middle East. Then the great challenge came for me, how then to tell this story. My previous book was about 6 days of war, the 1967 war, 6 days. Now I was supposed to write about 230 years, rather daunting. And I realized that in order to tell this story in a compelling and accessible way, I was going to have to identify the underlying themes which somehow bound this narrative together. The first theme that I identified was perhaps the simplest, most obvious of all. That's the theme of power. And by power, I mean the pursuit of America's interests in the Middle East by the exercise of power, whether it be military power, economic power, diplomatic power. Power certainly described the dilemma faced by Jefferson and other early Americans over whether to fight the Barbary pirates or to bribe them. And that dilemma loomed especially large in the spring of 1787 when not far from here, delegates from the states convened to discuss the possibility of federating these states under a constitution. They met under the shadow of America's first hostage crisis in the Middle East. 127 American sailors had been taken hostage by the Barbary States. 12 ships had been taken in the month of May 1787 alone. And indeed, the debates over the ratification of the Constitution are rife with references to the Barbary Pirates. Not only in maritime New England would you expect such references. People in New England were saying, if we don't have a federal government, we cannot have a navy, and if we don't have a navy, we can't survive. But if you went down to the southern states, there also, representatives to the ratification conferences were saying, if we don't have a federal government and don't have a navy, we will have these Algerines, as they called them back then, on our shores, and they will be capturing and enslaving our sons and daughters. America did unite under this Constitution. And 5 years later, in 1794, Congress voted into law a bill which earmarked $688,888.23 for the creation of America's six warships, six first warships of American Navy, and that bill, signed into law by George Washington, specifically stated that these warships were being constructed to fight in the Middle East. A long and often painful war ensued, America's first foreign war, America's longest military engagement ever was fought in the Middle East. The first American servicemen to fight and fall overseas fought and fell in the Middle East. In the Barbary Wars, it wasn't until 1805 when nine Marines, escorted by 250 mercenaries, marched 500 miles across the Libyan desert to attack Tripoli behind, to the shores of Tripoli from the Marine him. Or in 1815, when Stephen Decatur, and for whom about 27 cities in this country are named, and William Bainbridge, for whom a street in this city is named, sailed a fleet over to North Africa and subdued the Barbary Pirates. Not till then was that war concluded. Americans had learned their first lessons of power in the Middle East. A Middle Eastern threat had compelled the states to federate, to coalesce, had forced them to create power and to project power for the first time, thousands of miles beyond America's shores. And by creating a navy not to rule the waves, but to free them, America opened the seaways to the Middle East, to the agents of American faith. Faith, the second great binding theme in this narrative. And by faith, I mean, first of all, the impact of Christian faith, firstly, Protestant variety of Christian faith, on America's Middle East involvement. We're talking about an almost irrepressible missionary urge, not only to evangelize the Middle East, to bring the gospel of Christianity to the Middle East as understood by Protestant Americans, but also to bring the secular and civic faith of America in democracy, human freedoms, republican forms of government, to peoples of the Middle East who have been denied those freedoms. Now, this is the faith of colonial Americans who viewed themselves as the settlers in this new promised land. They had likened themselves to the Jews of the Old Testament. They called themselves the New Jews. This was the new promised land. And accordingly, they gave about 1,000 biblical place names to their cities and towns in these original 13 states. You know, tellingly, in 1783, there was a contest in Congress of what was going to be the great seal of the United States. You may be familiar. One of the contestants showed an American bald eagle holding 13 talons, one for each state. See, the arrows, one for each state, in his talons. The runner-up, another strong contestant, showed Moses leading the children of Israel across the desert following the pillar of fire. Moses came this close from being the national symbol of the United States. And that symbol was designed by Thomas Jefferson as well as by Benjamin Franklin. 3 years after the end of the Barbary Wars in 1818, America's first two missionaries, Pliny Fisk and Levi Parsons, left Boston for the Middle East. Their goal was to hasten the return of the Jews to Palestine. They believed that it was incumbent upon them, as good Americans and as good Christians, to help God fulfill his promises to the Jews in the Old Testament, which was to rescue them from exile and to restore them to their sovereignty in their ancient biblical homeland. Now, Levi Parsons and Pliny Fisk went to the Middle East, and they found that many Jews there were not eager to ingather into Palestine under the auspices of New England Congregationalists. They further found that when they tried to convert the Arabs, particularly the Arabs who were Muslims, that they risked losing their heads, because proselytizing under Islam is a capital offense. And so instead of proselytizing, Fisk and Parsons turned to schoolmaking. First, they introduced the first modern elementary schools in the Middle East, later the secondary schools. Several generations later, by the 1860s, the descendants of Fisk and Parsons were building the first modern universities in the Middle East, what later became the American University of Beirut, the American University of Cairo. And through these institutions, these missionaries no longer taught the Christian gospel, they taught what they called the gospel of Americanism, civic virtues, patriotism, democracy. They developed an entirely new identity in the Middle East, an Arab national identity, an identity that was secular of nature, that embraced both Muslim, Christian, Druze, and even Jewish residents of the Middle East. Many of the descendants of those missionaries went on to serve in the State Department, the so-called Arabists. They spoke the languages of the region. Many of them later on went to become executives in the oil companies, which occupied which exerted an increasing influence on America's Middle Eastern policies in the late 1930s and 1940s. They became closely identified with the Arab nationalist goals, and to the degree to which those goals clashed with the old restorationist goals of Zionism, restoring the Jewish people to their ancient homeland. There was a tremendous tension within faith-guided Americans, and to a degree, of course, that restorationist tension is today. Back home, many Americans remained committed to the restorationist idea. John Adams, the second president of the United States, said that it was his most ardent dream that 100,000 Jewish soldiers, as well-disciplined as the French army, that is the French army back then, would march into Palestine and reclaim it as a Jewish kingdom. Abraham Lincoln in 1863 acknowledged that the dream of restoring the Jews to their ancient homeland was one that was harbored by a great many Americans, and he hoped that the United States, once it was restored to its union after the Civil War, would be able to work to realize that dream. Perhaps the greatest expression of the restorationist idea, however, appeared in 1844 in a volume called Visions of the Valley. And the Visions of the Valley called on the United States government to spearhead an international effort to detach Palestine, then part of the Ottoman Empire, from Turkish rule, and to give it back to the Jews as a sovereign state. It even called on the U.S. Navy, created to fight in the Middle East, to provision that Jewish state until such a time as the state could stand on its own economic two legs. Visions of the Valley became an antebellum bestseller. It sold about 1 million copies back then. And it was authored by the head of the New York University Bible and Hebrew Department, a professor by the name of George Bush. And 2 days in the genealogy department of the Library of Congress enabled me to ascertain that George Bush was a direct forebear of two later American presidents by the same name. For some Americans, however, merely envisioning this recreated Jewish state was insufficient. And starting in the 1830s, groups of Americans, including large numbers of American women, such as Clorinda Minor from Philadelphia, moved to Palestine to create colonies in the Holy Land. And all of these colonies had the exact same goal. They were all designed to teach the Jews how to farm. The notion was that these were all good Jeffersonian Americans who believed that the basis of any modern economy is an agrarian economy. And they realized that the Jews had been exiled for 2,000 years, had been detached from the land, and they believed it was incumbent upon them again, as good Americans, good Christians, to teach these Jews how to farm. In 1855, for example, the Dixon family, Philip Dixon, his wife, and twin daughters, moved from Groton, Massachusetts, to a farmstead outside of Jaffa that they christened Mount Hope. The two Dixon daughters married two German Lutheran brothers. They were preachers in the land, named Johann and Frederick Grossteinbeck. And they proceeded to try to teach the Jews how to farm. The Jews did not want to learn how to farm. And this poor colony struggled in the face of disease, depredation, and attacks from roving Bedouin bands. But still the Americans came, driven by this faith-guided urge. 10 years later, 1866, George Adams from Indian River, Maine, left with 156 artisans, farmers, and merchants. They moved to Jaffa, too. And they set up another colony to teach the Jews how to farm. And they, too, experienced gross disappointment and starvation and loss. Now, the Christian advocates of Jewish statehood in Palestine, and their no less devout detractors, which continue to disagree. In fact, if you look at Jimmy Carter's book, you can see that they are disagreeing still. But I think the important point to note here is that whether they are in favor or against, they both stem from the same tradition, which is the tradition of the impact of American faith on the country's involvement in the Middle East. And finally, we come to the most elusive and mystical of these themes, and that is the theme of fantasy. And by fantasy, I mean the popular notion of the Middle East as a realm of unbridled romance and exoticism, of eroticism, of dark-clad nomads sweeping out of the desert on their steeds and sweeping away some innocent Western damsel off to the oasis and into his tent. Now, the roots of America's Middle Eastern fantasies go far back to colonial times. Back in the 18th century, the second most popular book on the colonial bookshelf, after the Bible, of course, was 1001 Arabian Nights, a collection of medieval Persian tales. You know many of these tales of Sinbad and Ali Baba. But there's also these images of minaret orbiting carpets and of veiled but available harem girls. By the 19th century, these lurid myths had lured many thousands of Americans to the Middle East. By the 1860s, Americans had actually surpassed the English as the single largest group of tourists in the Middle East. The Englishmen were always complaining the Americans had snatched up all the good hotel rooms in Damascus. Among the thousands who came was a writer whose previous book, Moby Dick, had sold a mere 3,000 copies. He was despondent. He was desperate to find a new source of inspiration for his next work of fiction. In 1855, Herman Melville packed two shirts and a toothbrush and set off for the Middle East. He kept an extraordinary diary. If you ever get a chance to read Melville's diary of his travels in the Middle East, it borders on the hallucinogenic and the postmodern. 12 years later, another aspiring American author by the name of Samuel Clemens boarded a steamship out of Philadelphia called the Quaker City. And he later published his collected dispatches from the Quaker City's visits to the Middle East. He called it Innocence Abroad. It became the largest selling book in the second half of the 19th century in the United States. Sold more books than the Bible, he quipped. And he used for the first time his new pen name. He called himself Mark Twain. Melville, Twain, and others soon learned that the Middle East bore no resemblance whatsoever to the wonderland described in 1001 Nights. And yet, still these fantasies persisted. Still these American tourists kept coming to the Middle East. And by the early 20th century, these myths of the Middle East are being appropriated by the burgeoning Hollywood industry. Some of Hollywood's initial blockbusters are Middle East fantasy films. You all remember The Sheikh of Araby, which propelled Rudolph Valentino to stardom. Or The Song, which came out the following year. I'm the Sheikh of Araby, my heart belongs to thee, at night when you're asleep, into your tent I creep. Like that? Those of us old enough to remember the 1974 big hit of Maria Maldauer, Midnight at the Oasis, same lyrics, it's just the woman singing the song. Now, there followed in Hollywood an unbroken series of Middle Eastern fantasy movies, the Indiana Joneses, the Saharas, the Hidalgos, those of you unfortunate enough to have seen that one. And they're making themselves, including some of which are up for Academy Awards this year. Mystified by these myths, many Americans might have wondered why these picturesque men on their camels would have left their palmy oases back in 2001 to come to the United States to hijack airliners and to fly them into large American skyscrapers. Power, faith, and fantasy. And sometimes they exist as independent themes in America's Middle East engagement. More often than not, though, they are in tension with one another. They are intertwining with one another, binding this narrative in sort of a thread-like pattern. For example, fantasy met up with faith in December of 1855 when Herman Melville visited the Dixon colony outside of Jaffa. He had lunch with Mr. Dixon. He had lunch with the Grosch-Steinbeck brothers, Frederick and Johann. 1 month later, Bedouin bandits attacked the Dixon farm. Philip Dixon was struck mortally on the head. His wife and two daughters were brutally and repeatedly raped. Frederick Gross Steinbeck was shot in the groin and died a slow and agonizing death. And the only survivor, really, of the Dixon colony was Johann Gross Steinbeck, who, according to consular records, left Palestine at this juncture, moved to California to prospect for gold, and there Americanized his name. Melville would allude to this attack on the Dixon colony in his 18,000-line poem called Clarol. This, not recommended. This wide. But he wasn't the only one to draw attention to this rape scene, of this terrible rape scene. So, too, did John Steinbeck's grandson in such tragic and biblical epics such as East of Eden and the Grapes of Wrath. John Steinbeck's grandfather had lunch with Herman Melville in Palestine in 1855 in a colony dedicated to restoring the Jewish state. Faith had met up with fantasy. Faith also blended with fantasy in 1867 when Mark Twain's Quaker City steamship helped evacuate the last 47 survivors of the Adams colony from Jaffa. And in his last chapters, Twain writes movingly of the suffering of the survivors of this colony. Power mixed with faith. In 1903, when Teddy Roosevelt sent battleships into Beirut Harbor to threaten the Ottoman Empire, whom he claimed was mistreating American missionaries in the city. Faith then trumped power. In World War I, when President Woodrow Wilson, the grandson, the son, and the nephew of Presbyterian ministers, had to decide whether in entering the war in 1917 he would declare war not just against Germany and Austria-Hungary, but also against the third member of the Central Powers Alliance, against the Ottoman Empires. There was a strong bipartisan support in Congress for going to war against the Ottomans. Former President Teddy Roosevelt said, if America doesn't go to war against the Turks, how can it claim that it's making the world safe for democracy? But Wilson was very close to the missionaries. And missionaries came to him and said, Mr. President, if you go to war in the Ottoman Empire, the Turks will do to us what they're doing to the Armenians. They were massacring the Armenians. Wilson never entered World War I against the Turks. With the result is that at the end of the war, there were about 1 million British soldiers in the Middle East, several hundred thousand French soldiers in the Middle East, not a single serviceman from the United States anywhere in the Middle East, and guess who got to draw the post-war map of the Middle East? Faith also collided with power in 1948, when after the UN partition of Palestine into a separate Arab and Jewish state, the United States was pressed with the issue of whether to recognize the soon-to-be-declared Jewish state on May 14, 1948. In a completely unique event in the history of American foreign policy, the entire American foreign policy establishment, the State Department, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, uniformly said to the president that if the United States recognizes this Jewish state, that the Arabs will go over to the Soviets en masse in the Cold War, there'll be a cutoff of oil to the West, Europe will fall to the communists, the United States Army will have to intervene in Palestine, send 300,000 soldiers there to defend the Jews of Palestine from the Arab onslaught that was soon to come right after the state was declared. The president was Harry S. Truman. A Baptist who read his Bible, he claimed to have known the Bible by heart by age 14. Truman listened to the advice of his entire foreign policy establishment. He closeted himself in the White House on May 13th for 24 hours, and at 6:11 p.m. May 14th, 11 minutes after the State of Israel declared its independence, Truman made the United States the first nation on earth to recognize this recreated Jewish state, completely ignoring the advice of every single one of his advisors, told him that if he did so, it would affect a global catastrophe. Since 1948, and America's ascendancy as the primary power in the Middle East, replacing Britain and France, the great colonial powers, with the deepening of America's dependency on Middle Eastern oil, America has struggled mightily to reconcile these competing impulses of power, faith, and fantasy. The result has been an almost dizzying zigzag in America's policy toward the region. Pursuing power, for example, in 1953, the United States joined with Great Britain in overthrowing an Iranian nationalist prime minister named Mohammad Mossadegh, whom the British and the Americans feared was becoming a little bit too friendly with the Soviets. But 3 years later, In a faith-guided policy of anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism, the United States turned on Great Britain, as well as on France, and saved another Middle East nationalist leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, from a certain overthrow during the Suez Crisis. American forces have fought against Libya, Syria, and Iran on more than one occasion, and yet those three states, as well as many other states in the Middle East, owe their independence largely to American intervention. American presidents have backed the state of Israel consistently, yet at crucial junctures they have withheld arms from the Jewish state and have pressed their leaders to relinquish territories which many Israelis considered vital for their security. Ronald Reagan in the 1980s beefed up Saddam Hussein as a foil to the Iranians and then turned around and sold arms to the Iranians in an effort to induce them not to take American hostages in Lebanon, thereby violating the primary law of the Barbary Wars. American leaders strove to establish a Pax Americana in the Middle East, and yet American forces have been engaged almost uninterruptedly for the last 30 years in the region, a 30 years war, and we in the United States have watched as the uniforms of our servicemen and women have burnished from a bright Vietnamese green back in the 1970s to a tawny Arabian brown today. In 2003, America invaded Iraq. And for one gleaming moment, it seemed that the bearers of American power in the Middle East, the American forces, were patrolling this fabled capital of 1,001 nights, that's Baghdad, and they were bestowing democracy on a people desperate to embrace those ideals. And that moment, alas, has proven quite fleeting. Today, Americans must again strive to balance the pursuit of its vital interests in this region with the precepts of its ideals, all the while striving to distinguish between the real and the mythical Middle East. That task is gargantuan. My book, I hate to disappoint you, does not prescribe a path for doing this. As an historian, I always say I have enough trouble predicting the past. But I do want to share with you my fascination with my readers, all of you, to tell you why the original Lady Liberty was originally an Arab woman with a veil holding a torch, why the original lyrics of the Star-Spangled Banner spoke of humbled Middle Easterners bowing down to the victorious American flag, and to hear about those stories, you're just going to have to read the book. Far more importantly, though, I want to instill in my readers an appreciation of America's extraordinary legacy in this area of the world. It's a legacy of militancy at times, yes, and of greed, but it is also a legacy of generosity, of tolerance, and even at times of courage. My aim is to provide a context of the past in which Americans, now profoundly and perhaps even existentially engaged in the Middle East, can begin to plot their future. Thank you. Thank you. We have questions, and we have a microphone which you can speak your questions into.
We do indeed, I'm sure, have many questions from the audience, and we have volunteers on each side with microphones to make sure that they will get to you quickly. And please wait for the microphone. I'm Elliot Shalkrut, president of the library, and I'm happy to call on the speakers, and let's get going.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Please raise your hand if you have a question.
Don't be shy.
Sir. Okay.
Right there.
Professor Oren, you've sketched out a kind of a vignette of the history of mentality of Americans looking in the Middle East. Where would you place the influential thought of a prominent academic like Edward Said within the perspective that you've painted? How would you analyze
There's actually a chapter devoted to Edward Said in the book, and I think I treat Edward Said as a historical figure, someone who was teaching a certain interpretation of the Middle East, the way the United States had interacted with the Middle East. I actually juxtapose him to Bernard Lewis, my old professor in the book, and who had a very different approach to the history of American involvement in the Middle East. Do you want me to go into detail about the way in which Edward Said differed from Bernard Lewis? Edward Said, is that a yes? All right. I was hoping to avoid it. It's always the most contentious issue. Edward Said's book, Orientalism, by the way, which was published during a period when I was just between the time I was in between degrees in graduate school, it totally changed the approach of American the way Middle East studies are taught in the United States. The preamble to his book says that over the course of he had studied Middle Eastern the way Middle East was taught over the course of 400 years in the West and the United States, and concluded that it was rife with prejudice and bias and intolerance toward the Middle East, and that the history of America that the study of the Middle East had been an ancillary to the imperialist project. Essentially, that Middle Eastern scholars in the West had served to render the Middle East into a sort of compartmentalized other that was easily conquerable. In other words, there was a conflict of basically that Middle Eastern studies was a tool of imperialism. Now, I had a problem with this as an historian. That theory cannot survive historical scrutiny because, first of all, the greatest Middle Eastern historians of the modern era were Germans, and the Germans were never involved as imperialist powers in the Middle East. But also in the United States, the first Department of Middle Eastern Studies was founded at Yale in 1841, long before the Americans were involved. Certainly, it could be even construed vaguely as an imperialist power in the Middle East. And the professor there was deeply devoted to creating bridges of understanding between the United States and the Middle East. Now, having said that, though, if you read the book, you'll see plenty of examples of what Edward Said would certainly call Orientalism. In the Middle East, there was during the going back to colonial times almost a systematic defamation of Islam in this country. Well, if you look back at the sermons of great theologians like Cotton Mather, Jonathan Edwards, just basically lambasting Islam. John Quincy Adams in the 1820s writes a 40-page essay. Denouncing Islam. I doubt he had ever met a Muslim. Mark Twain, Herman Melville had some choice things to say about Muslims also. So while maybe under pure historical standards, Edward Said's thesis can't be sustained, there's plenty of empirical historical evidence to show an Orientalist mindset in this country which existed. On a very fundamental level, I wrote this book in order to provide students of America's history in the Middle East and students of the Middle East in general with what I believe is a more nuanced framework. I view power, faith, and fantasy as among other things, an academic tool, a way to approach this history. And that history is far more multidimensional than that one presented by Edward Said. As I said before, yes, the United States pursued oral interests in the Middle East. Yes, it upheld some pretty unsavory regimes. Yes, it supported Israel at a time when that was certain to antagonize many people in the Middle East. But on the other hand, the United States built hospitals throughout the region. America built the first modern universities in the region, which deeply impacted the region. America stuck its neck out at crucial junctures to ensure independence for Middle East to the degree that it even went against its European allies. And I think it's very important that students in the Middle East understand that the situation is not so black and white. It's far more nuanced, and I wanted to provide them with a methodological tool for doing that.
Okay, another hand. Let's go right to this person, then we'll go over to the woman on the aisle there.
I actually have two very quick questions, and I'm going to admit my ignorance. I've only read up through 1877 in the book. But one of the things that interests me is the way that you talk about Americans in the book, but you don't seem to develop a nuanced understanding of the Arabs in the book. You don't present it doesn't appear like you tap the Arabic sources. It definitely seems like you focused in a very traditional diplomatic historical way on the records created by the Americans.
Yes.
So I'd like you to speak, A, to that. And B, I'd also like you to talk a little bit about your own influences. I mean, clearly, as an Israeli and an American, you have a very distinctive viewpoint.
Yes.
Being trained at Princeton, I can only imagine you have a very distinctive viewpoint, having worked with Bernard Lewis. So if you could talk about that and the way that it influenced what you set out to do.
Certainly. Excellent questions. The book is about America's involvement in the Middle East, not about the Middle East involvement with America. It'd be a different book. It'd be a book that, if I were to include both of them, the book would be far longer than it is now. It'd be about 4,000 pages. It would probably vie with Melville's Clarol. But apart from the fact that it is not that book, that's a different book, and there's a book to be written, and several actually books have been written about the way Middle Easterners perceive the United States, but much more is to be done there. But we also experience, there's also the methodological imbalance. The archives in the United States are open. The archives in the Arab world are closed. So we have a fundamental sort of asymmetry in the documentary evidence that we can marshal to study this. So every time I came across a public reference to the way the United States was perceived by Middle Easterners, whether it's in the writings of the Egyptian scholar Tahtawi in the early 19th century or later still in the way Arab nationalists perceived the United States' role at the Paris Peace Conference, I included that. There was some access to the Ottoman Empire archives, and I have used the Ottoman archives. But alas, you know, the sources are limited. So there's two reasons why I wrote the book that I did and not that other book. P.S., another reason why the book concludes with an essay that summarizes the period from 1948 to the present, rather than going into the detailed history that I used on the 18th and 19th century or the early part of the 20th century, again, because many of the documents, certainly post-1975, haven't been declassified in this country. So I'd encounter the same type of imbalance, and one wants to keep a certain continuity of depth, if you will. Now, my prejudices. I'm an Israeli. I live half-time in this country. I teach in this country. I live half-time in the state of Israel. I serve in the Israeli forces. I served in the war last summer, one of the many. And I'm proud of both of my allegiances. And proud of my Princeton education while we're at it. And of course, these exert an immense influence on my political thinking. And I don't disguise my political thinking. I write often for the Western press. I wrote, like last week, I had an op-ed in the New York Times, and I write often for the Wall Street Journal. I have an article this week in the New Republic that is rife with my political opinions. When I sit down to write history, and this is rather an unpopular approach in historical writing today, I take all of my preconceptions, I take all of my political opinions, and struggle to put them aside. I really do. It is a constant grappling process. And I ask myself almost on every paragraph, or not every line, am I being as objective and balanced as possible? Can I be completely objective? Can I be balanced? Of course not. No one can be. But I believe in that quaint old 19th century notion that there's actually a truth out there, and that it is our duty as historians, even if we can't reach it, to strive to reach it, at least. It was very gratifying for me to know that the Six-Day War book I wrote was very well received in the Arab world. I was just at Barnes & Noble in New York last week, and I was walking to the store, and a woman was walking out, and she was carrying my new book. And I went over to her, and I said, "Did you just buy that?" She says, "Yes." "I'm the author. Can I sign it?" And she said, "Yes." "What's your name?" "Wafa." I said, "You're Egyptian." She says, "I'm Egyptian." And I said, "You're buying my book?" She says, "Yes, I am." She says, "Well, I enjoyed your last book so much." So I was able to inscribe it to her in Arabic, which just gave me a sense of ego rush. And does that mean everybody likes everything I write? Not at all. And did that mean that people are not going to search my text to try to find my bias? And maybe sometimes they'll find it. Yes, they will. But this is the task that I've taken upon myself as an historian. It doesn't help me, and it doesn't help anybody in the end to write an historical text that really is just conveying a political idea. We want to get at the legacy, the heritage of America in the Middle East. I wanted to flush it out, and that's it. It's that commitment, but it's a process and an imperfect one.
Right over here. Then we'll go to the back over there, and then come over to this side. Mm.
In light of the three themes that you just described in your book, how do you view the present American administration's emphasis on faith, and how has that influenced, in your estimation, how has it influenced their positions in the Middle East today?
Monumentally and tragically. I don't think one can understand the full thrust of President Bush's faith-guided policy without understanding the historical context in which it took place. I mentioned this one book, you know, Valley of the Visions by George Bush in 1844, but Americans have been assiduously trying to export their faith-based ideology to the Middle East and their theology to the Middle East for well over 200 years. And there's nothing new about this. By the same token, the power component of the three has expanded exponentially after World War II because America became the preeminent power in the region because of America's dependency on Middle Eastern oil. Fantasy is certainly there. It's interesting. The book opens with the story of John Ledyard, America's first explorer in the Middle East, 1788. Good friend of Thomas Jefferson. He corresponds with Jefferson, and through this correspondence, we get a glimpse of what the Middle East looked like to an American in the 1780s. Amazing story. And one of the themes that Ledyard identifies is what I call in the book the liberty-loving nomad. Ledyard believed that the Arab peoples were inherently freedom-loving. He was very much enchanted by the notion of the frontiersman as well, the notion that there's a man on a horseback who could roam the great empty expanses of the desert or the plains, and the only thing he had to fear was a tyrannical government. And he believed that if the United States would come and remove the tyrannies of the Middle East, that the Arabs would rise up and seize their natural maximize their natural tendency for liberation and freedom. I see elements of that fantasy in America's involvement in Iraq, too, the notion that we would go there and that the people, the liberty-loving peoples of Iraq would embrace our form, our concept of liberty. I'm skeptical.
Moving back to the question there.
Yes, I have not read the book, but I read in the brochure that it's 700 pages. How many?
So reserve a week. It's 600. The text is 600 pages. The last 200 pages are what they refer to for some reason as N matter.
Okay.
It's only all the notes in the bibliography. That's N matter. Yeah.
Okay. My question is very simple. How much space do you give to things like Melville's diary, the Twain book, Innocence Abroad? The fact that the Statue of Liberty at one time was supposed to be a Middle Eastern woman. And how much space do you devote to Mossadegh's fall?
Okay. Well, the space is not equal because the Mossadegh episode falls within the concluding essay. And you have to read the book to understand why I wrote a concluding essay from 1948 to the present. But it's certainly there, and it's certainly prominent, and I discuss the reasons behind Mossadegh's ouster from America's perspective. It was a power-induced policy. I always say that the primary task of an historian is decision-making. You are presented with really a limitless number of facts, stories, episodes, and you can't include them all. Again, you think 700 pages is a lot? If I began to, what you're looking at the 700 pages is actually a fraction of what my research has revealed, really a fraction. And some things are so painful to cut out, you can't tell you. Every day you're sitting there with tears in your eyes, throwing things away. And what your criteria for what goes in and what stays out are the episodes, the chapters in America's Middle East involvement that are the most reflective and illustrative of America's overall approach, whether in this case of power, faith, and fantasy. So if I look at Melville and Twain, it's because I want to illustrate the way in which 1001 Nights, for example, helped lure these two American writers to the Middle East and the disappointments they experienced in the way there, and the way their experience in the Middle East was emblematic of those of many other American travelers to the region. If I want to look at the Statue of Liberty incident, I want to discuss the way in which America's growing power in the latter half of the 19th century impacted its relations in the Middle East. And I also want to expose, again, some element of prejudice, because when that statue was brought, sold to the United States, and it's a whole story, you're going to have to read this, people who purchased the Statue of Liberty insisted that the Arab woman with the veil be replaced by an American-looking woman, which is why the Statue of Liberty looks the way it does today. That, I see, is my primary task. At the end of the day, there's always going to be somebody who's going to say, how come you didn't include X? How come you didn't include Y? Or why you included A, B, and C? And there are perfectly legitimate criticisms, by the way. Some of my reviewers have said, I didn't discuss this or I didn't discuss. They're perfectly legitimate. But at the end of the day, the historian has to take responsibility for his decisions of what he left in and what he included, what he excluded.
Okay. Yes, we had right on the end here, gentleman there. Right? Yeah, good.
Who and what do you read for recreation?
Fiction.
Who?
Fiction. I also write fiction. I've published a couple of novels. My recent one was published by Penguin Press called Reunion. They sell dozens of copies. And the best compliment I can always get is that my history reads like fiction. And I'm working on that. So I read a great amount of fiction. I'm reading a wonderful work of Japanese fiction right now. But I also I read history. I'm trying to keep abreast of all the books coming out of the Iraq conflict now. I've recently read Looming Tower, which is excellent, and I'm just ordered Fiasco. It's quite an industry coming out of this. This war has yielded. But some very, very fine works of history.
Okay. The gentleman right here, and then I want to go to this side, right here, the woman, young woman right there.
The impact of faith and fantasy and the use of power is pretty clear. How would you reveal to those in power how the fantasy is impacting on decisions?
That is, I know, it's the question I always dread. Thank you. It's interesting. The gentleman earlier asked me about my relationship with Bernard Lewis, who I greatly revere as my teacher, really one of the last, perhaps of a generation of just unparalleled scholars of the Middle East, but I greatly disagreed with him over Iraq. In 2003, we were both asked to testify in front of a subcommittee on Middle Eastern affairs in Congress, and he was, of course, very supportive of the war, and I was against it. And I was against it not because of WMD. At that time, no one really knew what Saddam Hussein had, what he didn't have. There was strong suspicion that he did have it. But my opposition to the war stemmed from my reading of Iraqi history. I knew how Iraq had been created by the British. I knew how it was maintained by the British. I knew how it was maintained by Saddam Hussein after the British left. And it was always sustained as a unified state through the exhibition of just savage central power. I know how the British suppressed their insurgency in the Middle East and in Iraq. And I expressed sincere doubt whether the American people were so constituted that they could exhibit such savagery. And I think in the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib scandal, you saw the degree to which the United States could not exhibit such savagery in the Middle East, would not put up with it, and would not countenance it. And my advice to the subcommittee was, do not send your army into Iraq, at least not permanently in Iraq. If you want to take out Saddam Hussein, you want to look for the WND, do that, but do not get involved in the state-making business in the Middle East, because you cannot be butchers in that way. And so there was a tremendous amount of fantasy involved in this notion that America could go into Iraq and still uphold its ideals as a freedom-loving people, somebody that values human lives in that way, and bring democracy and unity to this Iraqi nation, which had only been held together before by brutality. There was fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The woman here, and then we'll go back further in that aisle.
Hi, thank you. I'm in my second year of college right now.
Oh, there you are.
Hi. And I remember the years of history classes in high school, and sorry to say they were very boring to me, but they didn't mention the Middle East at all. And now I'm able to vote, and the issue of the war is the 600-pound gorilla in every room, every discussion of politics in America, and I know nothing about it. And that's why I'm here. And I think that a lot of people don't know much about it. How do you think the current issue will change education, and how do you think it will change history books?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. Thank you so much. I've been personally involved in this. I mentioned before that I teach half-time here. Last semester, I taught the course Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America and the Middle East, 1776 to the present, at Harvard and Yale. Next semester, I'll teach it at Yale again, and then the semester in 2008, I'll teach it at Harvard again. Now, I think it would have been unthinkable 3-4 years ago to have a professor come over from Israel to teach American history, about American history and involvement in the Middle East, but there's a tremendous desire, tremendous interest, indeed a thirst for this knowledge today. At Yale, I had over 200 students in my class. And by the way, a great number of students with head coverings of various sorts. And at Harvard, actually, I was invited by the Arab Student League to address their class on America's involvement in the Middle East. Just really extraordinary openness on campus and a great desire. Now, last, there's only one of me. And if you read the introduction to the book, you'll see that one of the reasons I wrote the book is to hopefully create a whole new field of the study of America and the Middle East. We need the field. So if you're in the second year of school and you're thinking about going on to an academic career, where you want to talk to me later, we can arrange a little fellowship for you. This is true about all aspects of Middle Eastern studies, not just American involvement in the Middle East. One of the great fallings, one of just the immense handicaps faced by American forces in the Middle East is that people do not speak the languages of those areas. It's not just true of American servicemen and women in the Middle East, but also security forces at home here. And not just speak the language, but are versed in the cultures and understand those cultures. The book has there are all sorts of sort of piquante stories in the book. One of them, you know, the United States entered World War II via the Middle East in the invasion of North Africa, Operation Torch. The 74,000 American GIs who landed were handed out a guidebook to the Middle East. And this is all they knew about the region. It said, do not offer Muslim alcoholic drinks. Do not lift up the veil on women. There was actually a photograph in this handbook that shows two Arab men holding hands, as Arab men will hold hands, and the caption under the photo says, this is not what you think. Flash forward 60 years later, you're going to stop laughing, American servicemen and women going to Iraq were issued what's called the Iraqi smart card. It's actually online. You can see it. It's the same card. It's the same thing. Don't lift up the veil. Don't shake hands with your left hand. Don't step, you know, into a mosque with your left foot. Don't offer a Muslim a drink. Holding hands is not what you think. This is what we progressed. We have not progressed at all in 60 years. We've gone from the handbook to the smart card. The only difference is it's digital. And it's just not good enough. It's not good enough. Friends, you know, I often hear the comparison. I'm sorry for going on about this. It's just important that I say this. We often hear the comparison between what's going on in Iraq and Vietnam. And some of us who are old enough to remember America's evacuation from Vietnam, 1975, the image of those helicopters being pushed off the decks. And we went home, and we didn't have to worry about the Vietnamese coming after us. We will eventually withdraw from Iraq, but that does not mean we can detach ourselves from the Middle East. The Middle East is not detaching itself from us. And we are going to be engaged in this region for a long time to come, and we are going to have to learn about it, all of us, for our sake and the sake of the Middle East. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think that was such a great response. I know there are many, many more questions, but we want you to buy the book, go upstairs, sign the book, and meet Michael Pollan himself.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.